Welcome to the Finance and Investing Channel, brought to you by FT Press. I'm Julie Pfeiffer with Wharton School Publishing. I'm pleased to have with me today Stuart Lucas, who is a fourth-generation heir to the Carnation fortune, an accomplished wealth management advisor, and chairman of Wealth Strategist Network, an independent provider of strategic wealth management education to individuals, families, and financial institutions. Stuart has been deeply involved with managing his own family's wealth for the last 10-plus years. And through his experiences in this role, as well as being a senior executive in prestigious investment and wealth management firms, he has written the book, Wealth, Grow It, Protect It, Spend It, and Share It. Stuart, welcome and thank you for talking with us today.
Well, thank you, Julie. It's great to be here.
In your book, you provide advice wrapped around a set of principles for people managing wealth, whether it's $1 million or $1 billion. Please tell us more about your framework for wealth management.
Well, one of the things that I tell people is that a lot of the basic principles that they used to create their wealth will apply to managing it as well. And basic issues like starting with your values as a leader in describing what you do, learning about the businesses that you're involved in this case, the wealth management business. Establishing really solid infrastructure so that you can hold people accountable and align interests with people, and then using your wealth to empower you, your family, and society. These are ways in which you can manage wealth effectively over the long run and having it work for you rather than you working for it.
And that's very interesting. And applying this to your family, in 1985 when Nestle bought Carnation, it obviously had a great impact on your family's wealth. Tell me more about the opportunities and challenges that this purchase created for your family.
Well, in many ways, it changed everything because most of the family's wealth had been tied up in Carnation Company stock. And the sale in 1985 was an all-cash sale. So suddenly, there was liquidity. There was also a lot more autonomy by individual family members to pursue their own objectives because there wasn't the primary focus on the company anymore. And of course, we had to change the economic engine for the family because, again, Carnation was no longer available and we had a lot of cash, but we needed to figure out how to have it continue to work for us. And then lastly, the family had been for several generations tied into the food business as their primary career. And that was an opportunity certainly which could be pursued, but most people decided that they wanted to have a change in careers. And in fact, the last family member to stay at Carnation had left within about 6 months of the completion of the purchase by Nestle.
And you know, when you talk about your family, I'm curious how many people are involved, both directly and indirectly.
Well, that's a great question because it asks you how you define family. And one answer to your question is you could look at the living descendants of E.A. Stewart, who founded the Carnation Company in 1899, and there are well over 100 of those. On the other hand, because there really wasn't a plan in place when Carnation was sold to Nestle to deal with the issues that I was talking about earlier, there was this process of entropy that took place within the family, and many of E.A. Stewart's different descendants sort of went in their own independent direction. So there weren't the ties that bind us together. And then there's a third element of family, which is instead of looking from the patriarch or the wealth creator down generations, each nuclear family within the family actually is the merger of two family trees going back in time rather than forward in time. So you can define family in many, many different ways. And the way I like to think about it is how many people are in your family of affinity rather than your family of blood. You know, who shares common interests, common goals? because it is those affinities that are going to define and drive the future of family wealth.
That's a great point. And with that affinity, how do you, with those people, find common ground for your wealth management strategies with those people that are involved?
Well, in our case, we really started relatively small. So when it became time to figure out what my family was going to do, we defined my family not as the 100 living descendants of E.A. Stewart, but rather my parents, my three siblings, our spouses and myself, and our nine children. And so it was with that group of people that we really defined how we were going to, or we wrestled with how to find common ground. And I spent a lot of time having individual conversations with people and then having group conversations to strengthen those affinities and to find other areas where we might work together. At the same time, I built a case around why there was benefit for us to work together, because we could tap better expertise, we would have larger scale if we worked together by combining our assets, we would have focus. And then for those people that weren't involved in the actual management of the financial assets, they would have much more administrative ease in dealing with their assets because somebody else would help them manage it. And then lastly, there was a financial incentive to get everybody to work together that we were able to build in because of some timing issues related to some restructuring that we were doing. And so that was an additional incentive to get everybody to come together. But if you didn't have the basic affinities, then nothing else was going to work. And fortunately, to this day, we really focus on continuing to reinforce those affinities and to explore them as our lives grow and change and develop.
Yes, and can you expand upon those affinities and talk about the characteristics that would be involved in your family's investment and spending strategies?
Well, let's start with spending. There's a story I tell in my book about my father, and we moved back to the United States after living a few years overseas in 1965, and he bought himself a brand spanking new car, a Plymouth Valiant, which is not exactly a hot rod. And in fact, it's the only new car he has ever bought. And he held on to that car and loved that car for about 30 years before it finally gave up the ghost. And he ran the international division of Carnation Company, and it created a very specific dilemma for his overseas CEOs when they came to report to him, because he would invite them out for dinner, and he was living in Los Angeles, where it gets quite hot in the summertime when people would come into town. And they had the choice, these foreign CEOs, of driving around with my father in his air-conditioned Plymouth Valiant that was now 20 years old, or in the brand spanking new Cadillac that his vice president owned and was encouraging them to drive in greater style and comfort. And of course, they all decided that driving with the CEO and the son-in-law of the CEO of the entire company was a good idea.
Right, exactly.
But it also was not lost on his children that maybe image isn't everything.
Yeah.
So we try to have a mindset which is reasonably frugal on the spending side. Because actually spending is much more controllable than investing. On the investing side, we have a strategy which in some ways can be summed up in the following, which is that we try very hard actually not to let our ambition exceed our acumen. The investment business is possibly the most purely competitive business in the world, and there are a ton of extraordinarily smart people that are all competing to outdo each other. And even though I've been in the business for over 25 years, and I work with my sister-in-law, who's been in the business almost the same length of time, we are quite humbled every day by how much we don't know. And we find that we make our biggest mistakes when we think we know more than we do. So that is kind of fundamental to what our investment strategy is all about.
I think that's great, and the fact that, you know, especially in your spending, you pull from past generations. How do you plan for future generations?
Well, one of the things that we do that's pretty fundamental, again, is we try to set a culture for the family that has basic values, going back to that core framework. And one of the values that we have in our family is we tell people that they're going to need to recreate the wealth of the family in each generation. They can't simply live off of the fruits of other people's hard work. And there's a second element of what we do, which is we try to encourage deferred gratification, which again goes back to the spending policy. I was told, I don't know whether this is true or not, but I was told a great story of some scientists who a number of years ago did a little experiment, and they invited small children into to do a study, and they sat them down at a table and put a cookie on the table. And then they made an excuse for needing to leave the room, but they told the kids that when they came back, they would bring a second cookie. And if the first cookie was still uneaten on the table, they could have both. But if the first cookie was eaten, then they wouldn't get the second cookie. And then they tracked these kids and their business success for the next 30 years. And there was a direct correlation between the success of the child in later life and their ability to forego the one cookie that sat in front of them because they might get two later. And so we focus on that. But ultimately what it all comes back to is good parenting as a family value.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. And stepping back, not just about your family, but thinking about your career as an advisor and as a member of a wealthy family, what would you say is the most important lesson that you've learned?
Oh, gosh. probably gives more credence to this lesson and less to some others that are pretty good, but I'll give it a shot. I think it's really critical as a wealth advisor or as a member of as a leader within a wealthy family to try to figure out how to help people to pursue their passions. And sometimes that means helping them identify them and explore them as well. But at the same time, helping them to develop and maintain a set of discipline in their lives and around the management of their wealth. And if you can do that, both help them pursue their passions and then set up that framework, that discipline for managing in their lives, then they will ultimately lead happier and more productive lives. And the way to do that, again, is really to create an environment that is supportive of this kind of thinking. And that would be true within, you know, if I were developing a wealth management organization or in what I do in managing our family's wealth and in the way we communicate with each other as a family.
Stuart, this has been very interesting, and I know it will be very useful for our listeners. I want to thank you again for taking the time to chat with us today.
It's been my great pleasure, Julie. Thank you so much for your time as well.
Thank you. To learn more about the roads to effective wealth management options and which strategies are the right ones for you, check out Stuart Lucas's book, Wealth, Grow It, Protect It, Spend It, and Share It, which is now available in paperback at whartonsp.com.